Welcome to Great Australian Lives.
For Tobin Brothers Funerals,
celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight has spent many a day getting into the minds of some of our greatest Australians, or those who have had a huge influence on our country. As a writer of historical biographies, it's his job to meticulously research the facts behind his subjects, then bring their worlds to life on the page. He's now written a staggering 17 acclaimed books, including bestsellers Macquarie, Banjo, Mrs. Kelly, and Monash. And while he's an award-winning journalist and holds a Medal of the Order of Australia for his writing, tonight he's also going to introduce us to the notorious adventurer and scientist Sir Joseph Banks, the subject of his new book, Banks. Grantley Keyser, OAM, welcome to Great Australian Lives. How are you?
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to come on and talk about Banks. He was such a fascinating character.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure to have you. There is so much to talk to you about. You've had an incredible career. Firstly, congratulations on publishing your 17th book. That's a huge achievement in itself. It is a beautiful book. It's adorned with those iconic botanical illustrations of Australian native flora that Sir Joseph Banks shared with the world. I mean, that in itself is just beautiful, the front page and the inside pages.
Oh, yeah, ABC Books and HarperCollins have done an incredible job. It really is a gorgeous-looking book. And the botanical theme, of course, Banks was one of the great botanists of all time. But the thing that we wanted to convey through the book was he was bringing these things to Europe that Europeans had never seen before. He was meeting peoples that Europeans had never seen before. And he was introducing the European world to cultures and peoples and things and plants and animals that they had never seen before. It was because of him that Europeans got to know what a kangaroo was, because he'd had his artists draw them and he'd seen them in both what's now Sydney and North Queensland. And the Aboriginal people there told him they were called kangaroos, and he wrote kangaroos down in his diary, and that's how the name became widespread. And they became objects of enormous curiosity. Yeah. Eventually some live ones were brought to London, and they were hit at the time, these strange bounding animals. Banks likened them to jerboas, which is a little rodent in Africa that hops around. He thought they were giant jerboas initially. He was an incredible man. He brought back more than 30,000 botanical specimens from what's now known as Australia. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, that is, to have that appreciation of what's native to, as you say, what's now Australia. Now, first of all, Grantley, you have researched and written about some extraordinary subjects and Australians. Why Joseph Banks?
Well, I was always fascinated by him. He's often seen as an adjunct to James Cook, but in his day, when the Endeavour returned to Europe, the press called the great voyage Mr. Banks's voyage, and Cook was seen as the hired help. And that's pretty much the way that Banks initially regarded James Cook. Banks was a fabulously wealthy young man. By the age of 21, he was earning a multi-million dollar income that he'd inherited from generations of the landed gentry in England. But unlike a lot of his very wealthy, well-heeled friends who spent their money as wastrels wandering around Europe in gilded carriages in holidays of debauchery and seeing the great sights of Europe, Banks wanted to educate the world about the natural world around him. From a young age, he was fascinated by science and nature. As a boy, his mother even encouraged him to do things like rub toads against his face to dispel fallacies and the belief that they caused warts and whatever. And he would astound and astonish his friends by kissing toads on the lips and saying, they're very harmless. Let me tell you about everything else in the natural world. So from a young age, he was fascinated. Wow. By plants and animals, and he made it his life's mission to educate the world. He, as I say, he could have been like a lot of his other very rich young friends and just blown his money on having a good time. Mm. But instead, he left his grand home in London and his vast estates that produced a huge, huge income, and he financed the greatest scientific voyage of all time, which was the voyage on the Endeavour led by Captain Cook. And he paid for a large chunk of it. The Royal Navy provided the ship, and he paid for it to be outfitted as a scientific expedition. He took a team of scientists and artists with him, and some of the illustrations in the book are from the artists who went with him to capture just the astonishing array of new plants and animals that most Europeans had never seen before. So he was an extraordinary man in that way. And when he came back from the Endeavour voyage, 3 years going around the world, they went to South America, then on to Tahiti to see the transit of Venus, which is which was a vital astronomical event that they needed to help with ocean navigation. After that, they went to the coast of New Zealand, met the Maori, met cannibals, documented all their dealings with people who were incredibly fierce and performing the haka all the time. But they spent several months in New Zealand mapping and charting and documenting what they saw. And then, of course, they came to Australia. And after Banks finally returned to Britain, he was the toast of the scientific world. He was still only in his late 20s, but he was able to parlay that adventure into more adventures, and he became the most important man in British science. At a young age, he was made president of the Royal Society, which is still one of the premier scientific organisations in the world. And for the next 50 years, he was pretty much in charge of the Royal Society. He was able to finance and back and support and organise most of the great voyages of exploration undertaken by Britain for that next half century. So the mapping of the west coast of North America, he organised with a guy called George Vancouver, was the skipper of the ship, and Vancouver is named after him. Vancouver sailed to Western Australia and then up right across the Pacific Rim up to North America. So that was all organised Banks. And he was also behind so many explorations into Africa and into great projects of cultivation in India. He saw that as the kitchen or the storehouse of the world to feed the multitudes. And so Banks was very much into promoting agriculture as a way of better feeding the world. So he did so many important things for the history of the world as we know it.
I was just going to say, you know, knowing his influence on Australia, it's really interesting to hear about how much influence he's had around the rest of the world as well. Yeah. Often we look at, you know, that we sort of own these people, but there are many other countries who do too.
Yeah, well, it's the same with James Cook. If you go up to somewhere, even like Alaska, there's statues to him up there because those guys went everywhere. Even before he came to Australia, Banks had gone on previous voyages. As I say, he tossed in his lot to go on these little tiny ships and risk real life and death situations. He could have died many times, but he went to Labrador and Newfoundland in Canada, and he saw the great bears there, and he saw all the great fishing expeditions. Mm. And for several months there, he traipsed around in the absolute freezing conditions, documenting his experiences with icebergs, with walruses, the whaling expeditions that were going on there. So he brought news of all these things back to Europe. And all along, he was inspired not just by finding these new things to tell people about, but ways to improve mankind, ways to improve their economic production. And that was what he also saw when it came to Australia as well. He was the guy who really was behind the first settlement of Australia. The British government had all these problems with convicts. They couldn't send them to America anymore because of the Revolutionary War there. They were all in these ships called hulks on the Thames, polluting and crowding out the Thames, and it was a very dangerous situation. So they wanted somewhere to send these convicts and also settlers to form a new settlement. The original idea was to send them to the deepest, darkest parts of Africa, but it was quite dangerous getting them there, and a lot of the convicts had died on previous missions. So Banks recommended, he was the guy that recommended we should form a settlement in Botany Bay, and so the British government finally acted on that advice, and there we go. We've got Australia now as a result, 250 years later.
Incredible. Was he always on the list? I mean, we've mentioned you have an exhaustive list of incredible people you have written and researched on, but has he always been on the list for you?
I spent many years living in the south of Sydney around Cronulla and the bays down there, and Banks is very, very well known down there. He it's where, not far from there, Kurnell is where the first Europeans set foot on the east coast of Australia. Banks, Captain Cook, and a few others arrived there for quite an angry confrontation with the Aboriginal people. They stayed there 7 or 8 days and charted and mapped and had a good look around Sydney, and that's why Banks decided that Botany Bay would be the place to settle, to form a settlement. But, you know, even going further than that, as I say, I live down the southern part of Sydney. There's Bass and Flinders Point at Cronulla. Banks was behind the explorations of Bass and Flinders. He was the guy, you know, a young naval officer called Matthew Flinders wrote to Banks and said, "Sir, I need some help. I really wanted to do this voyage to circumnavigate New Holland and see if what we're calling Australia is really an island or it's connected to something." So Banks went to the government and said, this is what we need. We need this much money. I'll help out. I'll help finance it." So Matthew Flinders came out in the Investigator, and he was the first guy to circumnavigate Australia and prove that it was an island. And on that great voyage, he was charting and mapping the whole coastline of Australia, and again, meeting a lot of Aboriginal people. And Matthew Flinders was the guy writing back to Banks saying that these native people from New Holland are Australians. And so that's where we get the name Australia from.
Incredibly busy guy. Have you got the book with you at the moment?
I've got it right here, yeah.
Well, let's set the scene, Grantley. I'll get you to actually read the prologue of the book for us.
29 April 1770, Botany Bay, New Holland. Wide as the world is, traces of you are to be found in every corner. And that's from a man named Robert Hobart in a letter to Joseph Banks. Joseph Banks took a deep breath and looked nervously towards the coast of what would one day be called Australia. A group of black men, lean, muscular, menacing and defiant, stood on a rocky outcrop brandishing weapons and yelling at him and his companions. Banks was one of the richest young men in Britain, a tall, burly, handsome, bed-breaking ladies' man with a mass of dark hair and a ponytail. He was used to giving orders, not taking them. But the men on the rocks wanted him and all his companions to go back to where they belonged. For thousands of years, the Gweigal, a clan of the Dharawal Aboriginal people, had hunted and fished undisturbed around this sheltered bay among the sandstone cliffs facing the Pacific Ocean. Such was Banks's lust for adventure and love for science that he had left behind a beautiful fiancée and a life of luxury to help fund one of the greatest scientific expeditions the world had known. A three-year voyage around the globe on the Endeavour, which would claim enormous territories for Great Britain and change the course of history. Banks had used his vast wealth to fund a team of scientists on what the great naturalist of the 21st century, Sir David Attenborough, called an epoch-making voyage. The Endeavour took Banks to places no European had seen, as he and his team documented peoples, lands, plants and animals, while ushering in an age of discovery for Europe. Banks had forsaken the comforts of his London mansion and country estates for an overcrowded converted coal ship, enduring furious rolling seas and freezing hailstorms. He had shown courage and great vitality as he journeyed off the map for the sake of scientific discovery. Some of the men who had embarked on the voyage with him were dead from drowning, drunkenness, and the grueling conditions, and many more would perish before it was over. Now Banks was facing agitated warriors who had never seen white skin before. The Gweigal believed their unwelcome visitors were from the spirit world, and in their language began to cry out, "You are all dead," warning their loved ones that angry ghosts were approaching. The unwanted guests, as pale as sun-bleached bones, were covered in cloths of different colours, with some the British Marines in coats as red as a fiery sunset. Banks and about three dozen Europeans under the command of Lieutenant James Cook, a big Yorkshireman, were in two small wooden rowboats moving towards their first contact with the Aboriginal people of the east coast of this mysterious land. Alongside Banks in his boat was Cook, as well as Daniel Solander, a short, stout Swedish scientist, and Tupaia, a heavily tattooed Polynesian priest with an extraordinary ability to navigate by the stars and to find his way around the languages of the Pacific peoples.
Grantley, an incredible opening to the book, and it really does set the scene of those early days of, you can't even say Australia because it wasn't Australia yet, but I'm sure that it's really important to you to document that the Indigenous side of this story and respect what we are becoming, I guess, more knowledgeable about.
Yeah, well, very much. Banks has been criticised, and of course European colonists have been criticised for the treatment of Aboriginal people. And I make the point that if Banks and the British hadn't settled in Australia, we'd probably be speaking French or Dutch because someone else would have come. So Banks had enormous respect and enormous curiosity in other people's lives, and he was very, very keen to document the lives of the Aboriginal people and tell people in Europe about them. He spent several weeks in North Queensland because the Endeavour was beached up there undergoing repairs after hitting a coral reef where it was thought that perhaps the whole crew might drown. They were getting smashed on the reef up there. So Banks spent many, many weeks there getting to know as best he could the Aboriginal people, and he had a lot of respect for all the Indigenous peoples that he met, also in South America and New Zealand. His artists brought back drawings of the Maori and the Aboriginal people to show Europeans of these people who made lives for themselves in very different conditions on the far side of the world.
Incredible stuff. Well, we'll leave it there just for the moment and go to a quick break. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And in these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au and plenty more with writer Grantley Keyser in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tobin Brothers now offer fully live streamed services so that anyone who cannot attend the funeral of a loved one can still view the service and participate. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Our guest tonight is Grantley Keyser, acclaimed writer and journalist who's just published his 17th book, Banks, a rich and rollicking biography of one of the most colourful and intriguing characters in the history of exploration, and that is, of course, Sir Joseph Banks. Before the break, we heard the incredible prologue to the book. It is such an incredible story, an adventurous story, and I love the way you described him, Grantley, as this sort of rogue, this playboy. You don't often hear a lot about that side of these characters, do you?
Oh, it's amazing. We think about Victorian mores and morals, but Banks lived in an era before Queen Victoria where it was pretty much a sexual free-for-all, especially if you were wealthy. And the tabloid kind of press of the time really, really played it up. When he came back from his adventures in Tahiti, where he had many amorous experiences there, he was mockingly referred to as the circumnavigator, and the tabloid said that he had explored all corners of the known world, including a lot of female flesh. In fact, Banks later in his life once wrote to a friend saying that he had tasted women's flesh in all corners of the world. So the press at the time called him a bed-breaking ladies man. They said that when he was a student at Oxford, wow, he was notorious, you know, for his love affairs. And yet it's quite strange. By the time he got into his late 30s, he married and settled down and became a very respectable and very sedate country squire. But certainly in his youth, he was a notorious playboy. In fact, one of his great friends and his mentors was the wicked lecherous Earl Sandwich, who gave us the name Sandwich because Sandwich was a great gambler.
Good on him.
He used to like playing cards and not eat with a knife and fork, so he'd get his servants to bring him a couple of pieces of bread with meat in the middle, and that became the sandwich that we know today. But Sandwich was one of the main people behind what was called the Hellfire Club, which was a club of debauched rich people in Britain who got up to all sorts of escapades with lots of frolicking with courtesans dressed as naughty nuns. And they used to have mock black masses in this abbey in Britain, and Banks was invited along, but there's no proof that he ever actually attended the weeks of debauchery. They were really, really scandalous times, and a lot of Banks's friends were involved in this sort of thing. But as I say, Banks's great lust wasn't, even though he was a great ladies' man, his great lust was for science and adventure, and he showed that all his life. That was his abiding passion, was educating the world about science and the natural world.
I think I need to go and have a shower, Grantley. This is pretty intense stuff.
I've got passages in the book repeating some of the papers said at the time, and this is quite very, very salacious. You know, I wouldn't be out of place in today's like Hollywood press. Right. Yeah, it's quite salacious, the things that Banks would get up to.
Now, you're talking about researching those parties of debauchery, and there's no proof actually you've attended. And that sort of reminded me of an interesting question for you. In terms of the process of writing these books, I can only imagine you would have to be so thorough, and it would take years to get your head around the facts, because you really have to be respectful of the facts here, don't you? These are such important people in our history.
Well, we're very fortunate that Banks and James Cook kept very extensive diaries and journals about the Endeavour voyage. And Banks was a prolific letter writer. It's estimated that he wrote or received over 100,000 letters, and so many of them, even though a lot were scattered around the world, a lot of them have been digitised in various libraries and repositories right around the globe. Banks is very much an international figure. Libraries in San Francisco, for instance, have a lot of his correspondence. Of course, libraries and museums in Britain have a lot of his correspondence. And I travelled extensively retracing a lot of his journeys and a lot of his life to country England and of course, in London and the British Museum, where there's so much of what Banks did is celebrated today. And the Maritime Museum at Greenwich, where some of the cannons that were on the Endeavour are located. So there's a great amount of information from that time, contemporary information about Banks. And it's extraordinary, even in his time, so many people wrote commentaries about Banks, not necessarily biographies, but commentaries. You know, some of them are quite scathing too. As I say, Banks was a notorious ladies' man, but people were even critical when he got married, saying, one of his botanical rivals wrote a book saying he didn't know why Banks had married Lady Dorothea because he could have done much better. Things like that would be in print. You know, quite scathing commentaries of his wife after the woman that Banks had had. So, yeah, it was a lot of tit for tat in those days too.
I'll bet. Sounds like it. It's very, very woman's day. Now, I want to know, with these people who are so well documented over the years, when researching and writing about someone like this, is your aim to find something new? And if you don't, how do you make it new and enticing to the reader?
Yeah, the aim is to find something new and perhaps to bring that information in a dramatic light, and also to explore the character of this man. You know, he's not just a figure that you see in a painting on a wall. He was very much a flesh and blood guy with the real emotions, real heartbreaks, real excitement, real passion about his life. And I try and bring that to the reader, try and convey the enthusiasm that he had for what were the great passions of his life, and try and bring that alive for the readers. And hopefully I've done that, because Banks was such an extraordinary man. His great adventures around the world finished by the time he was about 30 years of age. He climbed a volcano in Iceland to prove that it could be done, and risk death once again to prove something. He was, I guess, a lot in many ways like a wealthy mountaineer, in the same sort of mentality. They put everything behind them to prove things can be done. But after that, Banks became the big payroll man. He became the bank, so to speak, for any other adventurer that wanted to explore the world. And, you know, places like even Hawaii, Mauna Loa, the volcano in Hawaii, that was ascended because of Banks funding expeditions out there.
Incredible. What a guy. He's just so busy.
He's an extraordinary, extraordinary man. And when you look at the collections that he brought back, it's just breathtaking. He brought back 30,000 specimens from Australia back to the British Museum. You know, it's extraordinary they could even fit everything onto this small ship. If you've ever seen what the Endeavour was like, it's a very, very small ship. It already contained 94 people. And even though Banks was used to living in a mansion, he lived in a tiny little bedroom that he got for himself on the Endeavour with two dogs that he brought along for the journey. Yeah, quite an amazing man.
Just fascinating. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives, and more with writer Grant Lee Keyser in just a moment. Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tobin Brothers now offer fully live streamed services so that anyone who cannot attend the funeral of a loved one can still view the service and participate. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Our guest tonight is Grant Lee Keyser, acclaimed writer and journalist who's just published his 17th book, Banks, which details the extraordinary life of one of the world's most famous and notorious adventurers. Grant Lee's also a journalist and has had an extraordinary career. I want to know, Grant Lee, where did it all start? Did you know as a young boy this is what you'd be doing? Where do your writing genes come from?
Oh, I was just very lucky and very blessed. You know, sometimes as a young guy, I didn't realise just how lucky I was. I went to high school in Brisbane. I was born in Ballarat and lived the first few years there, and I've still got many wonderful cousins and relatives down in, and aunties down in Ballarat. But I went to school in Brisbane, and I was very lucky. It's very hard to get into journalism these days, but I went straight from high school into a cadetship at the Courier Mail in Queensland, and I worked off and on there for 40 years. And after a couple of years, the sport that I was passionate about was boxing, because I'd always been involved in boxing as a kid. And I went to Sydney and started writing sports for the Daily Telegraph in Sydney. And I was only there for a very short time, and I had thoughts of boxing professionally. And I went to train at the Newtown Police Youth Club, and a young amateur boxer was there training called Jeff Fennick. And his trainer, Johnny Lewis, he and I became friends, and he said, "Look, don't you worry about your boxing career, because I perhaps wasn't as talented as I thought I was." He said, "I want you to help me in the gym from now on." So I sort of became Johnny Lewis's right-hand man, and we guided, Johnny did most of the work, but we guided Jeff Fennick to the Olympics in 1984, and then, of course, he became Australia's most successful ever boxer, and I was in his corner for all his world title wins and all his victories. We parted ways after a little while and then got back together, but I always joke around Jeff that he never lost a fight with me in the corner, that, you know, maybe I was his lucky charm. He lost a couple when I wasn't there. But because of that association, I then just had a magic carpet ride for the next four decades through sport, going around the world covering boxing. You know, it wasn't even like working really in a lot of ways. I did cover other sports. I did cover, but that was my abiding passion. And I was just so lucky, you know. I met world heavyweight champions dating back to guys who fought in the 1920s. Max Schmeling, who was a reluctant symbol of Nazi Germany, but he was Hitler's great Aryan hero, even though he had a Jewish manager and he hated Hitler. But I met him, and I met all the great champions, all the way up to the Klitschko brothers and Frank Bruno. And, you know, I was in Joe Bugner's corner in 1987 when he fought Frank Bruno at Tottenham Hotspur's ground in London, crowd of 40,000. At the time, it was the biggest fight ever in Britain. And Bruce Willis and Demi Moore sitting at ringside. The ring, the arena was so jam-packed that I virtually had to climb over them to get it in the ring with Joe for the fight with Frank Bruno. And the winner of that fight went on to fight Mike Tyson, who I also got to know reasonably well too, because Jeff Fennick became Mike Tyson's trainer at the end of his career. So we spent quite a bit of time together in Washington. So I was very lucky, as I say, dream run through all of the great stars of Australian boxing. I was involved with most of them. I wrote the first newspaper stories about Jeff Fennick, and then the first newspaper stories about Jeff Horn, who became Australia's world champion in 2017 when he beat Manny Pacquiao before more than 50,000 people at Suncorp Stadium.
It's such a world away from the books we were talking about before the break. This is another life for you, this sports writing and journalism, which you have been really acclaimed for. How do you switch brains, I guess, from this historical stuff to the boxing?
I wrote a biography of Jeff Fennick, and I try to bring the drama and passion to that. And I guess every biography is similar in that way. You're trying to convey the love that person has, the feelings that person has, the emotions, the driving force behind them. And back in 2010, 2011, I was always intrigued. When I went to school, when I was about six or seven, we went to the Brisbane Museum, the old Brisbane Museum, and from the roof they had hanging a little tiny biplane. And it was flown by a guy called Bert Hinkler. He was the first man to fly solo from England to Australia in 1928, a great epoch-making voyage, like Banks in a similar sense. No one had ever done it before, and this little guy from a little country town called Bundaberg in a tiny little plane, no longer than a modern day car, a little tiny thing. He flew through raging storms, thunderstorms, over volcanoes, landed in the desert, the Sahara Desert, twice because he was running low on fuel and had to make emergency stops. Did all this extraordinary, and I was always intrigued by it. And when about 2010, I was in Bundaberg on holidays visiting some relatives, and I went to the museum that they have for him there, not knowing what to expect. And it was the most stunning museum I think I've ever been in. It was a country, but it was just state of the art, and the great displays they had of all this guy's memorabilia. And I met the lady there, and she showed me all around the museum, and her name was Colleen, and she showed me all around the museum. And I decided, I hadn't written any books, great biographies on great characters since Jeff Finnick. And I just thought, this guy's a phenomenal story. There was phenomenal. He also was a sort of bigamist. He had wives in two different continents. It just made the story just so fantastic and amazing.
Yeah.
So she helped me write the book, and it was a bestseller. And I ended up marrying Colleen some years later. So through that, I met my wife. So I was very, very, very fortunate.
That is incredible. It just makes your story even more interesting, doesn't it? That's beautiful. Do you find, Grantley, the process of researching and writing different if the person is still alive?
It can be, because they've maybe got a different take and different viewpoint than perhaps I have. I try and write things as I see them. I know that Jeff and I fell out over the biography because he painted him in too much of an aggressive, vicious light. He perhaps sees it as being more truthful now, but as a young man chasing sponsorships and trying to ingratiate himself with government people and people of high social standing, he thought that perhaps it made him out to be too much of a criminal, and we fell out over that. But perhaps 40 years later, he now embraces that aspect of his life. I'm helping with a film treatment about his life now, so he wants to play up that bad boy image a little bit more. So the way I saw it then, I think, is the way that it really was, and that has been the case. I've written other biographies of people who are still living. The story about Jeff Horn, he was very, very easy to deal with. He's a very, very charming guy. He's had a few setbacks in his career now, but it's very, very, very rare that we'll see a performance like we saw again, with him beating Manny Pacquiao. That was one of the great Australian sporting moments of all time in any sport. And it was great to see just a little battler come from nothing and achieve greatness like that.
That's what we love in Australia. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And in these challenging times, Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au, and plenty more in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Tobin Brothers now offer fully live streamed services so that anyone who cannot attend the funeral of a loved one can still view the service and participate. For more information, visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Our guest tonight is Grantley Keyser, acclaimed writer and journalist. And Grantley, we've talked all about the incredible historical figures that you've researched and written about. But in terms of those who are big right now, currently, who do you think in 20, 30, 40 years we'll be writing about then?
Well, it's extraordinary, isn't it? You know, I think maybe social media and 24-hour news cycle, I think, has changed things a lot. You know, like, you wonder what maybe someone like Abraham Lincoln may really have been like. You know, you equate that with someone like Donald Trump. If you made a collage of all his statements and whatever, he'd be just seen as a clown, wouldn't he, in the next century?
The people encyclopedia. Back thinking, well,
how was he leader of the free world? But, you know, we have so many great figures still. Looking at Joseph Banks, someone like David Attenborough, you know, the body of work that he did, and he more or less says that he follows in the work that Banks did 250 years later, that exploration, that educating the world about the natural world all around us. So I think we still produce some great figures, and you know, I hope I'm alive and probably won't be in 50 more years to write about some of the people that are making news now.
Yeah.
You know, I've been very fortunate. You know, I wrote a biography about John Monash and the great military figure in an institution in Melbourne, and it was wonderful to actually meet people who had a family connection. I interviewed his great-grandson and various other people, and I wrote on the opposite spectrum. Someone like Monash, even 100 years after the event, is still seen as this great driving force, this man who, in a sense, Banks was a similar personality and similar passions. He wanted to improve the world. He was willing to make his own sacrifices about his own life to improve the world around him. He was involved in all sorts of committees and clubs and whatever to improve the world around him. And at the opposite end of the spectrum, I wrote a biography about Ned Kelly and his mother, and I was able to meet members of both the Kelly family and also people who were family members of the policeman that he killed, you know. And it was interesting to get everyone's perspective on people who, they may not be great figures like a Monash, but they were certainly important in Australian history. history and have had a big place in Australian history.
Did you go to that beautiful little hamlet of Greta in Victoria?
Oh, wonderful. To the cemetery there. That's one of my favourite parts of the world. The northeast of Victoria is just magnificent, you know. Even though the Kelly story is very controversial, there is a romanticism about it. One of the writers covering the great siege at Glen Rowan said, could there be anything more fantastic than men in suits of armour coming out of the wilds to shoot it out with police? And, you know, there is that great romantic vision of Ned Kelly's in his armour, which still persists to this day. And you think about them riding through that high country on horseback through the snow and the great mountains there. You know, it is marvellous, marvellous chapter of Australian history. Not necessarily for the right reason, but very, very interesting.
Yeah, it is. It can be quite a controversial discussion to have with the right people. That is absolutely right. Do you know who you're doing next? I don't want to be disrespectful to the amazing work you've done and just released your 17th book.
Yeah, well, I've got a couple in the
Have you got someone else in your sights?
There's a couple in the pipeline. I'll probably revisit the Kelly story and maybe have a look at his story from the police perspective of the brave men and some women, but the brave men especially, who actually went out to confront this killer on the run. The popular feeling about Kelly is that he was oppressed, but you've got to think about these policemen who weren't earning much money. They all had wives and children to support. They had a job to do, and they risked their lives to go out and capture him. And then I'm also doing a big biography on the great Australian poet Henry Lawson, which is a companion piece to the one that I wrote on Banjo Paterson. He's the flip side of Banjo. He's the anti-Banjo, quite a very sad and tormented character all his life, and a very, very interesting man, and a beautiful writer, you know. His short story, The Drover's Wife, it's extraordinary. He only got a few shillings for it, but people today have parlayed it into works that, you know, earn hundreds of thousands of dollars in grants. But poor old Henry only got a few shillings to write. It was a beautiful story about the hardships of living in the outback.
I can't wait to read them. You must have all of these things sort of on the go at the same time. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, and I find writing the books, I also educate myself about Australian history because I'm finding out more and more and detailed, and I get to go to some pretty wonderful places. You know, talking about the books and researching the books. You know, when the Kelly one, I did quite a long tour of country Victoria. I went up to Wangaratta and I went out to Mansfield where the Kelly shootings had happened. And, you know, for Banks, I went, of course, over to Europe and fair ways around Australia looking at the places that he had visited. It's fascinating.
Absolutely. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. If you're listening tonight, Grant Lee's 17th book, Banks, a rich and rollicking biography of one of the most colourful and intriguing characters in the history of exploration, is now available at all good bookstores through HarperCollins. And if you enjoyed our chat tonight with Grant Lee Keyser, OAM tonight, and you'd like to share it with a friend, subscribe to the podcast. Thank you so much for being with us, Grant Lee. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And of course, join me the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.